Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. This week we've several books featuring on the programme. We talk to professional photographer Jonathan Hessian on the Atlantic coast of Ireland, a copy of which we have for one lucky Seascapes listener. And we have copies of Sailing By, published by the Liffey Press and RTÉ Radio 1, celebrating 25 years of the programme in our Seascapes competition. First to last weekend in Dúnlaoghaire, where over 60 radio officers from England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland gathered for a reunion. In a moment, we'll hear from the Vice President of the Radio Officers Association, Coleman Shocknessy, and about Mark Coney from radio officer and naval historian Joe Varley. First to Tony Selman, President of the Radio Officers Association.
Radio officers were unique in their position on board ships in the sense that no one else did the same job. So if you were stuck in the middle of the Pacific and some piece of equipment broke down, then there was no one else going to fix it other than you. And so that tended to create a certain level of independence and reliability that if you weren't going to fix it, no, it wasn't going to get fixed. And there were a lot of radio officers that eventually just died with the profession. It was a 100-year profession. It was roughly for the 20th century, 1900 to 1999. And our association was formed in 1996. Since then, it's grown. It dwindled a little bit as with the age profile. There was no people coming into the bottom to replace it. But we've had a bit of a resurgence in the last two or three years. Whatever people may tell you, nostalgia is what it used to be. And we get together twice a year. There's a great ambience. We just love to get together. We had a unique position on board, and we have a unique set of memories which we try and recreate. There's all sorts of small world scenarios that people haven't met each other for the last 40 years, or I install that piece of equipment on the ship that you were on, and it just creates a wonderful reunion type of atmosphere, which has admirably been recreated here in Dúnlaoghaire this weekend. Quite right, I'm the chairman of the Radio Officers Association, and about 3 years or so ago, we asked Coleman to become vice chairman. It's probably your listeners may or may not know, but within the British Merchant Navy, a quite high percentage of the radio officers were of Irish extraction, and a very large percentage of those worked for the Marconi Company. They seem to have some form of inside track with the Irish training schools. You got your ticket the day you were on a ferry next day on to join a Marconi ship, and Coleman is just tremendous as far as we are concerned. And he's been very, very active in firstly raising our profile in the Republic, and secondly in getting more members to come in. And he's done a wonderful job here this weekend. And what we've got here, we have 63 people sitting down to dinner here, which is the highest attendance ever in the history of a radio officers' reunion. And we've had a wonderful time. The Irish people have been very, very welcome. Nothing new there, but they've been extremely welcoming to us. And it's just been a fabulous, fabulous reunion. I work for two particular companies, but the second one of which was P&O. They were the most wonderful company to work for. I have to say that to some extent because my wife is also a former P&O officer. She was a woman assistant purser. But they were very, very good indeed. The radio officer's job, when he arrived in port, in some senses, he closed down. He had no one else to communicate with. It depended upon the company you worked for. Within P&O, for example, you were totally responsible for the maintenance on board. That didn't always happen in all companies, but as far as we were concerned within P&O, something that might have been limping along to get you there suddenly got stripped down just after you'd arrived, and you were probably, if you've been sort of 30 days crossing the Indian Ocean and you just arrived in Fremantle, you were far more interested in going ashore into the dives and flesh pots of Perth and Fremantle perhaps than you were about fixing an intermittent fault on a piece of equipment. But that was what you were paid for, and that's what you had to do.
But also people tend to forget that radio officers produced a newspaper on board cruise liners when they were finding their way across whatever waterway they were going.
Indeed, and that was one of my many jobs on board, including many other radio officers. It was called the press, and you used to receive it usually on the 12 to 4, that's midnight until 4 in the morning, and you received it from Portishead Radio, which was British press. You'd receive it from the United States, also from Australia, and if you had a certain number, the rule in P&O was if you had 30 passengers, you had to receive that press. We used to quite often carry a lot of Dutch passengers, and God help us, we used to have some oddball nations as well. And I can assure you, the steam coming out of our ears where you're trying to take the Polish press at 25 words a minute, and you haven't got a clue what you're receiving. But that, you know, it was good fun. I've been on many a watch where I come on watch at midnight, I've taken the headphones off another radio officer, and I've taken 4 hours of press pounding away on the typewriter. Most of us could touch type, which I still can, I'm delighted to say, and that was just a prerequisite of the job. That was, and that produced a 6 to 8 page newspaper, which these days, of course, you just press a key on your iPad, wireless, and up it comes. In those days, it was all typed out. We had the advantage of being technical. We started off as radio officers. By the time I left the sea in 1975, we were electronic officers, which meant that you were understanding new things like transistors and integrated circuits and all sorts of complex affairs like that. And that gave us the inside track on some of the new technologies. And some of us went into technological industries. Quite a lot of people went into radio maintenance, electronic maintenance. Some went into the computer industry, like myself. We had a reunion a few years ago where we were starting to chat around the bar, as you do. And we sort of compared, well, what did you do and where did you end up? And the end result of that was that we'd all gone down numerous roads, but we'd all ended up being fairly successful. And when we tried to analyze that, we came to the conclusion that we were all self-motivated, self-supporting on board. And I think that became quite useful to employers, that we had the ability to get the job done and we didn't have to keep turning around and press the help button. We went into the world of publishing, which we knew absolutely zero about a couple of years or so ago. We wanted to publish, in effect, our legacy. We started in 1900, we died in 1999, and if we weren't going to write it within the Radio Officers Association, then who on earth was going to write it? We have a quarterly journal through our association called QSO, which means communication in sort of non-technical speak, and we decided that what we would produce what at that stage we were calling Best of QSO. And then we thought, well, we need something slightly more sexy than that. And we came up with A Long Silence Falls, because radio officers were communicators. We stop, so it goes silent. And that was extremely successful. Beyond our wildest dreams, we agonized over whether we'd print 500. And we're up to 950 now, and we're just thinking whether we're going to do the next 50 or not to get up to a nice round figure. Despite all the three editors having spent a long, long time in the recovery ward after the strains of doing that, the three editors, including myself, have decided that we're going to produce another book because, same principle really, I suppose, it's simplistic. If we don't do it, no one will ever do it. And it was extremely well received last time, so we're hoping we'll be the same this time. Over the last 2 years, we've taken on 100 new members, which, when you consider that most of our age profile is not getting any younger, for obvious reasons, we've probably, of that 100, we've probably recruited 30 from Ireland, which almost single-handedly is down to the efforts of Coleman Shaughnessy, who we referred to previously. And we've also decided, because there were so many Irish radio officers at sea, that this time we were going to allocate a complete section to them, because we've got quite a lot of stories. You know, if 25% of our membership is Irish, then we're going to get, you know, 25% of their stories on a rule of averages. And so we've got a complete section, including, I'm delighted to say, several stories relating to World War II. And I'm delighted to be here this evening where we have two World War II veterans. We revere those people in our profession. They're basically, certainly as far as an Englishman is concerned, kept the country going during the Second World War.
Tony Selman, President of the Radio Officers Association. Next, to the man who made it happen, Coleman Shocknessy.
We had them from Scotland and Wales and from England, and the Irish lads and the guys from Dublin turned out, and some of the guys from down the Midlands that we know, and they all seem to have enjoyed. We had a fabulous meal in the National Yacht Club, highly recommended. Manager was very, very good to us there, and some people stayed in the Royal Marine and some of them stayed in the Kingston, so we covered everybody. Our AGM now will be in Leeso Castle in Liverpool in April, on 19th of April. And we'll have a gathering there, about 50 people in Norway is the average there. But Tom Frawley and myself always go across, and our wives come across, and they enjoy the weekend. And so we build on that. The first one that came out, we had three lovely stories: Pat Gleeson from Limerick, Tom Birmingham from Wexford, there were very, very good stories. And John O'Sullivan from Galway. John is my friend in Galway. John is 89 now. And John took the telegram. Germany has surrendered unconditionally. And, you know, I'm the proud owner of that telegram. You know, a lot of us would love to have kept our telegrams, some of the telegrams we had, and the experience we had over the years, which was a unique job.
Coleman Shocknessy, Vice President of the Radio Officers Association. Next, to a radio officer and naval historian, Joe Varley, on the significance of Marconi and the Marconi Company to the role of radio officers.
I think part of it was the fact there would have been a radio school in Dublin and there would have been a radio school in Limerick. And it was an attractive job because it was a sort of a job, you were fairly well qualified, you could get instant employment. And very, very often, if after maybe 4, 5, 6 years, maybe 10 years at sea, if you felt, well, you weren't going to go to sea anymore, radio and various aspects of electronics were developing. So a lot of the radio shops, a lot of the, in every part of Ireland, both in Dublin and in rural Ireland, would have been started by radio officers. I think there was a few things came together there, and they were all in his favour. One was the very fact that kind of he could speak English, he could speak fluent English. Naturally enough, he could, because he had an Irish mammy who would have been one of the Jemisons, the whiskey company. But against that, he had a good sense of reality, to the extent that while he was brilliant technically, he was very good on the legal side. His stuff was copyrighted, so with the extent he was, people weren't snitching his ideas. And he was always prepared to experiment, because the ideas at the very start were very, very basic, but basically due to trial and error and one or two significant things in Ireland, all of a sudden he had developed a system where you could actually communicate without using wires.
What brought you into the whole area of wanting to be a radio officer and heading off to sea?
Dead simple. I hadn't got the eyesight to go on the deck side. I wanted to go to sea one way or another, and this is the way I went. I was unusual to a certain degree, because we all joined kind of 49 North Wall. Paddy Daly would have, and people would, who are listening would know Paddy Daly and remembering, the poor man is dead now. And then it was a total lucky dip, because what would happen, you'd be sitting there in the waiting room, and about 4 o'clock the postings would come in, normally on the phone from Liverpool. And you'd be hanging around all day, and all of a sudden 5 or 6 would be told you've gone on the ferry and they have ships for you in Liverpool. But as it was, I got the Irish plane out of Dublin. And the captain at the time kind of would have been Captain Poole, and Eric O'Shea was my senior. And rather than going to Liverpool, I went up to Eden Quay, and I have an Irish discharge book and I have an Irish seaman's identity book, which most of the ROs kind of have British ones. It was just pure luck of the draw, you know. But the thing about Irish shipping and the plane would have been characteristic on this. At the time, the plane had a Goulding's charter, and she was going into Dublin and Cork with phosphate, basic material for fertiliser. And what they did with the Irish plane was kind of, if guy's leave was up and he had another about 6 weeks to go and they wanted to send him deep sea, he would be on the plane for a few weeks. because basically she was always coming back to Ireland, and you'd clear Dublin and really you'd be back in Dublin again in about 4 weeks, give or take a day or two, you know. They were absolutely superb days. I think I was privileged to have gone there, and like, they've great memories. And on a weekend like this, kind of when you get kindred spirits, of course they were great days, and I think we were lucky and privileged to have experienced them.
The voice of Joe Varley. Next week on Seascapes, we'll be hearing from World War II veterans Tom Birmingham and Desmond Taylor, and the background to the Radio Colleges. Seascapes is 25 years on air this year. It began back on the 2nd of June in 1989 to the strains of Sailing By, composed by Ronald Binge. In fact, Sailing By was launched by Rear Admiral Mark Millett in the port of Cork earlier this evening, and will be launched at the National Maritime Museum in Dublin on Monday evening. Sailing By has many contributions from many familiar names down through the years, with a foreword from Rear Admiral Mark Millett, DSM. You can see more detail on the Seascapes webpage. All royalties from the sale of Sailing By are going to the Royal National Lifeboat Institution. Sailing By is in bookshops now. You have an opportunity to win a copy on the programme this week by answering the following question. Who wrote Sailing By? The original signature tune, his more famous composition, was Elizabethan Serenade. Answers on a postcard to Seascapes, RTE Radio 1, Father Matthew Street in Cork, or by email seascapes@rte.ie. Next to a resident of Dún Laoghaire, a professional photographer whose images adorn the magnificent The Atlantic Coast of Ireland, with text by John Grenham, and it's published by Francis Lincoln Limited. Last weekend, Seascapes met up with Jonathan Hessian to hear how the book came about.
As a professional photographer at the moment, I make my money working on film stills. And a lot of the time, I go up and down the coast of Ireland, and I'm working with a lot of actors who have a lot of equipment around them. And over the years, I've often wished that I could get a clear view of the background rather than the celebrities who I'm meant to be photographing. So as a result of that, about 3 years ago, I was working on a film up in Donegal called Grabbers, which is an intentionally made B-movie style science fiction job. And it was December, Donegal, just beautiful mountains in the background. And I then decided to do something about this. So I approached a publisher, Francis Lincoln, who had already published my wife's book on Irish gardens. They liked my photographs, and I suggested doing a project on the west coast of Ireland, on the Atlantic coast, and they jumped at the idea. And it's also provided a huge valve for me, an escape valve, creatively, to get away from just taking photographs for money, purely professionally, and to go out and explore things I really want to do. So I suppose it was born out of frustration. That's where I started my landscape photography, on a movie set. In fact, I did the publicity stills on Calvary, and I remember looking at Brendan Gleeson once again with Ben Bulbin in the background, and I hadn't been up Ben Bulbin at that point. And it was that very moment I decided to make a point of getting up to the top of that beautiful, beautiful mountain. So yes, we have the most astonishing run of scenery all the way down the coast, from Malinhead to Mizenhead. It's absolutely astonishing, and it's no wonder that Forge Ireland have gone with their Wild Atlantic Way, although I gotta say I don't like the amount of signposts they put up on it. Still, it's a great attraction for this part of the country. I've gotta say, the one thing that I find slightly, there's a bit of a gap in Irish landscape photography. Everything seems to be taken at sea level, or not much higher than that. And I decided to try and take a new approach. I also love mountain walking. So there were a list of mountains from Donegal all the way down, starting with, say, Muckish in the very north. Errigal, although it isn't on the coast, is a fine, fine mountain with beautiful, breathtaking views, all the way down to Carrantool in Kerry. But I've got to say, the most terrifying experience I had, and I've got quite a good head for heights, was on Slieve League, which you've mentioned. They are the second highest sea cliffs in Ireland, the highest being in Achill Island. But there's one maybe 10 or 15 metre stretch of the Slieve League walk, which is called One Man's Pass. And I had to make several attempts to get over it, because, to be quite honest, I just bottled out. On one side to your left, if you're traveling north, there's a drop of maybe 900 feet straight into the water. And on the other side, there's a maybe a drop of, I'd say, 400 meters onto rocks. And unless you have a good head, it's a really, really threatening environment. And thanks to my friend Pascal, who is like a mountain goat, he can dance his way across this particular bit of rock. He encouraged me, and I managed to grapple my way over it, freezing several times on the way. I'd say that 10 meters must have taken me 20 minutes to cross. It's the slowest progress I've ever made, but the most rewarding to have got across it.
Obviously, if you're tipping your way across those rocks, you're not laden down with equipment, or are you?
Well, I use Canon SLRs, digital cameras, and I decided before setting off on this project to try and keep the kit to a minimum. So I used a 28 to 300 mil zoom, which is a heavy beast. It's maybe 2 or 3 pounds weight, and a 20 mil prime lens, plus a 1DX camera, which is a beautiful Canon camera. So I managed to squeeze those into a backpack or a shoulder bag, in fact, that weighed maybe 5 or 6 pounds. And it was quite heavy. If I was going to do it again, I'd go for a mirrorless camera, which is half the size, and Sony now make a beautiful full-frame mirrorless camera that's about 7 or 8 ounces in weight. It would have been perfect.
What about your first camera and the whole start of this? What was the bug? I mean, a lot of us are of a generation that perhaps it was a box brownie that youngster you get as a teenager. What lit the flame for you?
Well, I fell into photography by default. It was never my intention to become a photographer. I left UCD after studying there for 10 days and took up a career in dishwashing in Captain America's in Grafton Street. And a mate of mine, whose dad was a photographer, took me aside and said, listen, do you want to do something different to dishwashing? Which I was quite enjoying at the time. So I became an unpaid photographic assistant for about 5 years. And I was given an old Leica camera, an M2 by my stepfather, and a couple of lenses. I used that for, I'd say, 3 or 4 years. And I traded it in against a Nikon F1. And I've been using SLRs ever since then. I spent about, I'd say, 18 months going backwards and forwards from my house in Dunleary to the West Coast. And I worked my way from north to south over, I suppose, a period of, say, two years. And the writing was done by my extremely good friend, John Grenham, who's a genealogist, an Irish Times columnist. He writes a thing every week called Irish Roots. And we've been buddies for 40, 45 years at this point, and we'd always been threatening to do something. And this seemed like the ideal combination of our talents. He's got a great feel for for Ireland, its customs, its people, its history. And he supplied a series of, maybe 20 really fine essays on to complement what I was photographing. This book is quite modestly priced. It's under 30 euros or whatever. To have made it any better than it is would have cost a fortune. The publishers, Francis Lincoln, did a great job. And I'd never be 100% happy, but I'm pretty happy with this, yeah. At this point, I've got to say the design work done by a friend of mine for years called Jerry Garland, she's a book designer and stamp designer for the On Post. She really made the best of the material, and I'm thrilled with her input into it. To be quite honest, I don't know a lot about boats, but I have a very good friend who kindly brought me across the Atlantic with him on a 38-foot rival about 3 or 4 years ago. His name is Johnny Byrne. He works on films, which is more or less how I know him. And he was short of somebody to do a bit of cooking, I think, which is about all I could do. So we spent 3 weeks going from Tenerife to St. Martin in the Caribbean. And prior to that, I'd spent a day with him just sailing around Dublin Bay. He's a great guy, and he's introduced me to sailing. I've been out on boats many times, but I've just never actually mastered the craft. And if there's anybody out there listening who wants to give me some education in that department, I'd love it. I mean, even to get a rowboat and go out from Dunleary Harbour or go out to Dorky Sound or to Dorky Island and look back, you see a completely different perspective of the place you live in. I mean, to look at Dunleary from Howth is a revelation. You can see things you'd never imagined. The lie of the land, how, say, Killiney Hill dominates the altitude over Dunleary, and you can see everything. You see things from a new point of view. But you mentioned something there, Marcus, about kids being taken out on boats. When I was a 4 or 5 year old, my grandfather organized for me to go one really, really rough day on the lifeboat from Greystones to Wicklow. And here I am, what, 55 years later. I can still remember the thrill of being out on a boat like that, just rolling around in the waves. It was a great thing for a kid to do. And I would encourage anybody who's got children to bring them out into the water. It's a whole new world. I think some of my favorite photographs come from Achill Island. The day I was up there, once again with my friend Pascal Bradley, the light was just perfect. We went up to Crohan. There were rainbows in the sky. There were beautiful clouds. It was just a magical day, and some of the photographs reflect that. There are many photographs in the books that I really like, most of them taken from mountainsides, looking down. But there's about 20 photographs I'd be really proud of in the book, and the rest I'm pretty happy with.
Photographer Jonathan Heshin, you can see a selection of images from the Atlantic coast of Ireland on the Seascapes webpage. Our competition for a copy of this lavishly produced volume, courtesy of Francis Lincoln, the publishers, we want you to name the highest sea cliffs on the west coast of Ireland. Answers on a postcard to Seascapes, RT Radio 1, Father Matthew Street in Cork, or by email to seascapes@rte.ie. Also, earlier this week saw the launch in Cork Airport by Lord David Putnam of Cork, The View from Above by aerial photographer Dennis Horgan, which features many magnificent seascapes off the south coast. We'll have copies for some lucky listeners on Seascapes next Friday night. Next week here on your maritime programme Seascapes, we hear more from the remarkable radio officers. We'll be talking to World War II veterans Tom Birmingham and Desmond Taylor. And we hear from Scottish instructor Willie Williamson, who taught in Liverpool. We'll have copies of the tide tables for 2015, courtesy of Maps and Charts. Author of Clippers, The Ships That Ruled the World, Daniel Nolan has the extraordinary tale of Queen Tepi of the Phoenicians and how she sailed to Ireland. All that and much more here on Seascapes. Until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.